Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to Getting Savvy in Health, Wealth, and Beauty. Important to note that everything is for entertainment purposes only. Please do speak and meet with a financial advisor before making any investment decisions. And also, please meet and speak with your GP before making any health or beauty decisions.
Good morning, everybody. We are filming on a Sunday, and I think everybody feels it's a little bit early. I'm still dark out for me. I'm in Aspen still. But here we are. Here we are. And we have a special guest. Melissa, why don't you do the honors?
Sure. So this is a friend of mine and fellow physician, surgeon, Dr. Phil Solomon. He's renowned here in Toronto for facial plastic surgery. And so we're going to talk to him today about facelifts. And I thought with all this like market volatility and people have been a little bit down, let's talk about how we can get lifted up and how we can, talk about facelifts. Because I mean, you know, it's becoming more and more something that people in their 40s and 50s are starting to think about. And it used to be something that people used to wait until they were like 60s, 70s. And now people are starting to talk about it earlier. So I think, I'm going to deep dive into it.
Deep dive. So maybe one of the questions I should ask, because it's not my area of expertise at all. Do you like to go by Dr. Phil? Probably not. Because there's a Dr. Phil, isn't there?
Yeah, well, Dr. Phil, the psychologist.
I do have a lot of patients call me Dr. Phil. They seem to find it amusing, but I'm easygoing. Phil or Dr. Phil or whatever you want.
Okay, thank you. I love the fact that they find it amusing. Anyway, why don't we just start with, so say somebody, they're in their 40s or their 50s, and they're starting to see their face change. They know they don't look like, I'm basically describing myself. they know they don't look like they used to. You know, and you can just see the certain areas that bug them. So what's the process? You make an appointment, and then do people say what they don't like? And then do you kind of say, well, no, or yes, and this is what we can do for it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, a lot of people come somewhat educated about different options nowadays. I mean, there's so much information out there online that many people come in with good information, but they also come in with not great information. And my role is to sort of assess them, just like anything else in medicine, assess physical examination, evaluate the patient's goals, and then determine what options they have. And they could be non-surgical to surgical. Our practice is, we do both, but the vast majority of what I do is surgical, including facelifts, pretty much everything surgical on the face, and then try to create a treatment plan involving the surgery, sometimes with addition of non-surgical options as well. And then, we sort of evaluate a patient often based on decade of life. So patients coming to see us in their 30s may often fall into a certain category. 40s, 50s, obviously different treatment options are available to them. And we don't want to stick completely to the age, but facelifts in particular is an operation that is used to be sort of appropriate for patients in their late 50s, early 60s. And nowadays we're doing them in younger patients. So that's one big sort of change in the plastic surgery world, is that facelift surgery, mini facelifts or short scar facelifts or even full facelifts can be done in patients in their early 40s and even rarely late 30s if the patients had some genetic factors or massive weight loss or things like that that have led to premature aging.
I have a question. Is there any downside to doing it too early?
It's sort of it's a great question, and it's something that different doctors sort of debate. I think you want to only offer surgery if it's indicated. So, we do see some patients who are relatively young who are looking to do facelifts at a very young age, but they're not doing it as a restorative procedure. They're doing it more as a facial shaping procedure. And most of those patients are doing filler and other non-surgical things and maybe are not reaching their goals, and they're reaching out to us to see is surgery even an option. And then I wouldn't say it's often an option, but very rarely we will see patients that have sort of rounder faces, heavy lower third of their face, just genetically. And in the old days, we would, offer them just filler to try to reshape the face and create a heart-shaped face by adding more volume at the top. But often it created more of a round look. And nowadays, occasionally we're doing facial slimming procedures, which would involve removing some fat in the mouth area called buccal fat extraction, shaving some fatty tissue along the jawline with neck liposuction, and then also elevating the tissues with often a mini lift. So those patients fit into sort of a unique category for facial shaping, whereas the vast majority of facelift patients are restorative and we're trying to make them look how they used to look, not different.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's one of the things they talk about with Bella Hadid and even like Ivanka, talking about doing this like buckle, removing the cheek fat, like the baby fat in the cheeks. And then all of a sudden you notice their face looks slimmer. So it's hard to know whether they just lost weight and then their face changed or if they had some facial procedure. But that's interesting. Okay, so that's something that patients might come in their 30s looking to sort of change the look of their face. Whereas when you get into your mid-40s, 50s, I heard, and tell me if this is true, that if you can pull more than 1 centimeter or 1 inch, then you're a candidate for a facelift. Is that true?
It was sort of like a loose sort of thing that we used to do with patients. Say if you grab onto the skin around the side of your ear, and if you can pull it out beyond your ear lobe, you may have enough skin to be considered for a facelift. But I think more importantly is when you're looking at a patient's face, if you find that their jowls are significant, meaning the soft tissue is descended down, because the lower third of the face, there's a ligament along the mandible called the mandibular ligament. And this area around the mouth is sort of adherent to the face, whereas the tissue above it is mobile. And as you age, starts to descend. So often you start seeing like what you would treat with filler, marionette folds, but just below it, if the jowl starts to hang over that, those are the patients that are sort of candidate for a repositioning procedure. And then on the neck, we look for things like banding, and you'll see platysmal banding starting to form often in the 40s. So those are sort of the two most common telltale signs. The third would be heavy cheek as the cheek descends as well. The fold known as the nasolabial fold, which often is treated with filler to camouflage it, becomes deeper and the cheek starts to hang over it. So all of those three things are things that are best treated with surgery, but not everyone wants surgery. And that's where you get into this entire part of the industry of non-surgical lifting procedures, from radio frequency devices, ultrasound devices. The trouble is we offer a lot of those because many patients fall into that age bracket where they're not ready for surgical intervention. But in my opinion, and many surgeons' opinion, a lot of those procedures are sort of hit and miss. They're not totally predictable in how much they can restore. They almost slow things down a bit, maybe reverse them a little bit. But there are a lot of money, pain. Some of them are somewhat uncomfortable to do, specifically the ultrasound one, like Althera. Even though it's a good device, it kind of hurts, and they've modified the technology to be less painful. And other devices such as SoftWave have come out with, you know, slightly different use of ultrasounds that are less uncomfortable, but there are thousands, and then the results sometimes are subtle at best. And so we see a lot of people who've spent thousands of dollars on some of these non-surgical devices in that in-between age group, and they're the ones coming for maybe early facelift. So at least with that, they sort of reset the clock up to, you know, 7 to 10 years, sometimes more, and then they can use some of those devices to maintain their result after the facelift. So you'll hear different things with different surgeons. Some doctors are against technologies. I'm sort of a big adopter of technology combined with surgery and, you know, and filler and neurotoxin to sort of try to use them all as different tools.
But what's the neurotoxin?
That's just the generic term for Botox.
Oh, okay. Okay. Question two, though, it's interesting because when you do, you know, to Melissa's point, see a lot of these celebrities or, you know, people in the news that have had obviously something done. And, you know, it's one thing to have a facelift, and it's another thing to do the almost the facial like reshaping. And the reshaping, I think, in many cases looks so good. But, you know, like how do you even, I don't even know my right question, but even like the buccal fat, I would almost think that as you age, you might actually want extra fat in your face as opposed to getting it taken out. What do you think?
No, I agree. I mean, part of the aging process is loss of facial fat, but I think it varies patient to patient more than anything else. So it's hard to generalize. Like you'll see patients who have had buccal fat and it was a terrible decision to do that procedure. It's advanced their aging, but then you see other patients who have beautiful long lasting results. So it's incumbent on the doctor to make the right diagnosis. So if someone's got really, really chubby cheeks and they're in their 30s and they feel like they look 16, they may be a good candidate to do a buccal fat procedure because they want to look a bit more, I don't know, elegant and more mature and not look like a teenager. Those patients we often will do it on, but we really are careful on who we'll do the procedure on. And like everything, when a procedure becomes popularized, then it becomes overdone and then you start seeing complications. So you'll see, you know, people posting, oh, buccal fat's a terrible procedure to do, be cautious of it. But then it's often patients who probably were not candidates at the beginning. So like everything, it's a good procedure when done on the right person for the right indications, and it can be used as part of your aesthetic enhancement procedures. With older patients, like we sometimes see people who've had facelifts and like Ruth, like the example would be like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They talk about, like, if you have a picture and you look at her, she'd had facelifts done. But if you looked around the sides of her cheeks here, she had these bulges. So she had probably an old fashioned facelift, which may have been pulling a bit more on the skin, but her fatty tissue was dangling down, almost creating pseudo jowling. And sometimes a patient like her probably would have benefited from having buccal fat trimming at the same time as her facelift. So, you know, she's just an example. I've seen her sort of brought up at different meetings where we're talking about how do you use buccal fat as part of a facelift. So nowadays that we've modernized facelift surgery, and again, not all surgeons do the same procedure, but I'm a big proponent of what's known as the deep plane lift. And in the deep plane, we're working in deeper tissues. We actually can access the buccal fat from the facelift incision rather than going through the mouth. So we sometimes do modify and reposition or trim the buccal fat, which is sort of the fatty tissue here, to give more of a elevated mid-face area and to reduce some of the fullness on the sides of the mouth. In certain cases, it enhances the facelift results.
That's interesting. So you're actually really attacking the buccal fat from a completely different area to be able to almost still use that fat within the face, just somewhere else.
That's right. Rather than just removing it, sometimes we reposition and things like that. But it's sort of a nuanced part of facelift surgery. I don't want to, you know, dwell on it too much because there's so much more to talk about.
Do you remember that episode? Catherine, did you ever watch And Just Like That? You know,
no.
Like the Sex and the City reboot?
No.
Did you, Phil?
I don't know if I saw it, but I know it came out and it was a sort of a revisit of a lot of the characters.
Yeah. So then there was a funny episode where she goes into the plastic surgeon and she's like, what could I do? Like thinking it's going to be some little thing. And then he comes out with like,
oh no,
every single thing on the, like, do you ever do that? Mm-hmm. We ever like recommend like a bunch of different procedures for somebody?
Well, I say to patients up front, I'm going to start kind of at your hairline here. I'm going to go down to your collarbone and I'm going to critique sort of every area of your face. And then you and me together will then look at that and pick what actually bothers you, because as everyone ages, their entire face, I mean, it's universal. It's not like you're sort of picking on the patient. You're saying this is a universal process of aging and varies amongst people. We're going to look at your particular case from head to collarbone, and we're going to then determine what options you have. Most people have similar options. You know, the upper third of the face is whether you adjust the brow, the orbital area is whether you do a blepharoplasty. The mid-face, lower face, and jawline is either volume restoration or lifting. And same with the neck, it's lifting. So those are kind of all what we look at. It really is relatively straightforward. And then it's each person, whether they want to do all of it or part of it. And in some cases, they can pick and choose and a facelift's all they want. Other people need really to do everything so it looks most harmonious and natural. Sometimes more is more natural than less. Sometimes less, you almost end up with, you know, part of the face looks age and part of the face looks young. Like for me, when someone says, I'm going to leave it in your hands, for me, it's often the best outcomes we're going to get. And then there's the issue of economics and risk tolerance. You know, that's really what's holding people back are those two factors. Some people come in with the economics issue is not an issue. They just want to, they're going under an anesthetic and they say, doctor, you tell me what I need and I'm going to put my trust in you, and you tell me what I need, I'm going to go for that. Other people say, this is my budget. What's my biggest bang for my buck? And other people say, budget's not an issue, but I'm terrified, so I just want to do one thing. And sometimes they end up doing something small just to get confident, and then they come back and do a little bit more. So those are kind of the three patient types. I don't know if you find that in your practice too, Melissa.
Yeah, totally. And oftentimes, some people are like, just do everything, you know, and they're the ones that want, you know, Botox and Sculptra and, you know, radio frequency and microneedling and filler. And there's other people who need to start small and sort of get their feet wet, and they don't want to look different. There's a lot of people that are very scared of looking different. They want to look fresher and more youthful, but they don't want people to know, like, what did you have done? Like, why are you so different looking? So I think that's a big thing as well.
So I'm curious though, because I think that, you know, even for someone like me, I'm very fearful, you know, of going under. So, but what's the difference though, Dr. Phil, in terms of, you know, starting small? Does it mean a small procedure so that you're under anesthetic a shorter amount of time?
Some patients get procedures done under local anesthesia, so it removes the risk of the anesthetic that's causing them anxiety. Also, there's different degrees of anesthesia. There's local anesthesia, which some cases like upper blepharoplasty or laser resurfacing of the face, we can do under local, because some people are scared of going to sleep. And then we also offer sedation versus general anesthesia, and those are just different degrees of an anesthetic. The big difference between the two is really how deeply sedated you are. With what we call IV sedation, it's like you're fast asleep, but you don't have a tube in your mouth. You're breathing spontaneously on your own. You're sort of in a deep slumber and you're comfortable, versus a general anesthesia. You have a breathing tube put down your mouth, and you're being supported by a ventilator. So there's differences of anesthesia as well. Not every patient necessarily understands all this, but they may ask, you know, what are the options, you know, of anesthesia, and how does that sort of fit in with what I'm asking to do? Sometimes it doesn't match. Like some people say, I want local anesthesia for only, and I don't want any sedation. And I'm sort of like, well, look, from my experience, I want to focus on your surgery. I want the anesthetist to keep you comfortable. And that procedure, you need to at least get sedation. Like a facelift, I would want someone to be sedated.
Yeah.
Whereas
you could do a
upper,
facelift, you mean you could do a facelift without putting them to sleep?
They're pretty much like under like a colonoscopy level of propofol drip in our office. And I'd say 50% of our patients elect to do that. The advantage being that they wake up much quicker. They often have less nausea from the anesthetic. They seem to bounce back quicker, and they're discharged. They go home from the facility quicker. But if someone's doing multiple procedures like brow lift, facelift, eyes, then they may want to be put to sleep more. Just usually, if it's less than 3 hours, 2.5 hours, we'll do sedation. If it looks like it's going to be longer, we may do general anesthesia.
That's so interesting, isn't it, Melissa?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it helps people feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you were just going to do like,
I'll see you on Monday.
Exactly. Okay. But now let's talk about the other side.
We just decoupled your risk. Now you're in a different category now.
So that's the risk though. Okay. So that's talking about the risk of the actual procedure. What about some complications people need to think about after? What are some complications that you can see as a result?
Facelift surgery. The commonest, the biggest risks are related to just surgical risks in general versus specific risks to a given procedure. So specific risks, well, I'll say general risks are like bleeding, infection, scarring. That happens with every surgery, or can happen. And those are the known risks of all operations, and then anesthesia risks. Specific risks for facelift surgery would be whether you're not totally satisfied with the aesthetic outcome, meaning it's not tight enough or it's asymmetric or one side needs an adjustment. That can happen even when surgery is performed perfectly. Sometimes things just settle a little bit. But with our newer techniques, I find that the rates of touch-ups, specifically in patients in their 40s, 50s, up to about 60, is very low. Older patients who have a lot of soft tissues may get a dramatic improvement in their 70s, but still find there a little bit of laxity there and may need a tweaking a year later. So I tell people, if you're depending on your preoperative assessment and what your goals are, we're probably going to get you like really close to as perfect as we can when you're younger patients, up to about 60, 65. Older than that, we're going to see what we can do and do the best we can to give you a natural look that doesn't look overly tight or pulled. Because some of those patients, their skin laxity and the amount of descent and ptosis, we call out of their neck, is severe. And you're going to make them way better, but it depends on what people forget where their starting point is. Some people come in with a little bit of a band, and we show them their pre-op, and they had like a neck down to like they had no neck at all, and then they're like, oh wow, I really do look way better. But the other risks relate to numbness around the ears, common. That usually resolves in almost every patient up over a few months. And that's because we're detaching all around the ear. There is one nerve called the great auricular nerve, which runs right in our surgical field, and we do our best to avoid injuring that nerve. If that nerve were even cut, it still would cause numbness, but still likely would regrow. So it's not the end of the world, but it's something that we avoid. Other major risks would be nerve damage to a motor nerve known as the facial nerve. And with the deep plane facelifting, that's the nerve that we're most worried about damaging. If someone does a lot of deep plane facelifting surgery, the incidence of nerve damage, permanent nerve damage, would be less than 1%.
Oh.
Based on the literature. So it's very rare, but temporary nerve damage or stunning the nerve where your smile's crooked for a few weeks can occur. I've seen that happen in my patients. I've never had one that's lasted, but whenever you see it, you're always a little bit worried or anxious that the patient's got some nerve, temporary nerve injury. But again, if a surgeon were to, obviously not on purpose, but come across one of those nerves and not recognize where they were, someone who hadn't done this technique often enough and who got into bleeding and they weren't sure of the anatomy, then that would be one of the biggest risks of this type of procedure would be nerve damage.
So why don't we just talk a little bit about the what deep plane is? Because I think a lot of us have probably heard about this, seen it on Instagram with various celebrities having it. Like, what is deep plane versus a regular facelift? And because I think you seem to like to do the deep planes, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I evolved into using this technique over 20 plus years of doing facelifts. And, facelift surgery is divided into sort of conventional facelifts or old-fashioned facelifts, where it was predominantly lifting a big skin flap and lifting it up. And that operation improved things, but it had often a windswept look. You weren't really addressing any of the deeper structure. So you're pulling one layer over another layer. So as you age, basically the face is aging as a composite. The deeper structures, or what we call the SMAS area, which is like a leathery structure over the entire muscular part of the face, descends with the skin. And so the deep plane is that you're going underneath that leathery layer known as the SMAS. There's debate in amongst different doctors. Doctors that like this operation, who've adopted it, really like it. The doctors that haven't adopted it will say it's not that different than something called a SMAS lift, which I also perform and use for over a decade. A SMAS lift is that you're lifting that big skin flap up, as I mentioned at the beginning, and then you're doing a separate flap under the SMAS, the leathery layer. And so you have sort of two layers, and some doctors who like that technique say, well, now you got two layers, so you could be more artistic in where you put everything. But many surgeons that have adopted the deep plane feel that having a composite or a thicker flap where your skin and that leathery layer are attached to one another prevent that tightened, drawn, pulled look or windswept look. And also the structure is thicker and more structured. So when you're moving it up into different positions, you're moving the entire face as a composite, and things seem to just look like they should have looked, rather than detaching and pulling different layers apart. And you can say, well, why not do composite lifting on everyone? I find it's a bit of a learning curve, and for certain surgeons who maybe like their technique, don't are reluctant to switch. I was sort of
Sure.
fortunate enough, like I was exposed to the deep plane at a very early stage in my career. I didn't utilize it because I think I was still a relatively young surgeon. I was being quite cautious. And then I cultivated it by visiting different surgeons around North America who were doing it. And at that time, it wasn't a popular technique. There were literally in every big city, maybe one surgeon doing it at most. And with the internet, it's sort of, there are a couple surgeons who really popularized it, wrote books on it, had big social media presence, and they sort of got a lot of recognition for it. And now it's sort of a little bit like anything else. You're getting some people pushing back on it. Some surgeons who don't do it are saying, oh, it's an old technique and there's nothing unique about it, and it's been done for many, many years. But I've done all the techniques. I can tell you that in my own practice, that technique, it was the one big quantum leap in my results. I felt my results really took it to sort of like the best results that I've had in my practice were by using this technique. There's many other technical considerations that are more detailed that your audience may not need to know, but the one is that when you're in that deep layer a lot, you start seeing things that you don't see when you have all different skinny layers of skin and fascia. The biggest thing is these attachments known as ligaments to the midface area here. And so many surgeons would get really nice results along the jawline and the neck with the older techniques, but this area of the cheek often was still hanging down. And when we're going in that deep layer or composite layer, we're able to really separate the cheek from the underlying ligament structures where the cheek's almost glued down to the underlying muscle. And those structures were never really even named. They're still sort of debated among surgeons at conferences. I was at a course in Miami recently, and a colleague of mine from California who's on the circuit and speaks a lot about deep plane lifting was doing live surgery, and they were debating this one area that was stuck down and what makes up that area, what are the structures in it. And to name them to me doesn't necessarily make any difference. The important thing is that there's an adherence of the cheek down to the underlying musculature known as the zygomaticus muscle. And to release that area is critical to really lift the mid phase. Once you do it, you'll sort of see everything sort of glides up. When you don't release it, you're sort of pulling against, you're pulling up and your cheek's pulling down. And so you're fighting it. And often without releasing it, the result of your facelift is not as good. So I've intraoperatively doing surgery, I've released everything else except that ligament and looked at how much lift I get. And then I've gone back in and released the ligament and I've got substantially more lift. So I've done my own sort of internal intraoperative sort of playing around with it as I developed my technique, and that's kind of why I'm a big proponent of it. I just find it really helps. But
Where's the scar for the deep plane facelift?
it's the same pretty much as regular facelift scars. The incision's not really changed. So some surgeons make incisions straight down in front of the ear. We usually do that only in males because of we don't want to move hair-bearing sideburns into their ear. But in females, we usually go into the hair in the front, like the temporal tuft, it's called. Like just where your sideburn goes up, sort of into your hair there. So that's hidden. You don't see any of that. Then we drop down into the retrotragal area behind the tragus, which is the nubbin in front of your ear. So it's just on the edge of that. So that scar is not really seen. And then we wrap around your ear lobe to the back of the ear and a short scar lift. That's it. We stop. In a full facelift, we continue back into the hairline behind your neck. So the scars again inside the hair. So you don't see those scars. We usually shave like a couple centimeters of hair at the very back and through here just to access where we're going to make the incision so that the hair follicles are left intact and will grow hair through the incision. There's like all these little subtle nuances you can do, which most, surgeons who do a lot of facelifts follow those similar techniques. That's not the big differentiator of the type of technique. And again, I don't want to just say deep plane's the perfect operation for everyone or the best operation. Just in my hands, I really think I don't see myself changing or going backwards. But I find it amusing because I sometimes see some colleagues throughout North America who don't do it, sort of poo-pooing it and saying there's nothing new to it. It's like been around forever. And it's actually not true. I mean, there are some nuances and subtleties if you do it that have evolved over 20 years, definitely during my career.
Did I hear you correctly when you said when you go to these conferences that there's a surgeon up there doing a live surgery?
Yeah, that's a very specific course. I wouldn't say that's every course that surgeons attend. There's one that's been held in Miami. I've been going to it for 19 years. As a I've just as a registrant to observe different facelift techniques, and they usually will have guys that are recognized for specific types of facelifts brought in from North America, different parts of North America, often who've done huge volumes of facelifts who are feeling that their technique's the best. And next year I think is the last year of that course. I think it's like the 45th year. So I've kind of gone to, quite a lot of them. So I've been watching it since I'm a young surgeon. And the deep plane lift has been presented the last 3 or 4 years that I've gone to. And the surgeons who put on the course are excellent facelift surgeons, but they don't do deep plane lifting. So it's always interesting. They do a high SMAS lift, which is a great technique too, but there's always sort of this internal debate. But I find it interesting because I'm like, well, they keep inviting different guys who do deep plane lifting to show it. There has to be something to it, or why are they so interested in this
But Phil,
operation?
I'm imagining like a big stage in an auditorium, and then there's a
No,
surgeon.
they video it from an operating room in downtown
Oh, okay.
Miami, and they present it,
Okay.
but the surgeons can hear the audience and the audience can hear the surgeons. So there's a moderator who's saying, hey, what are you doing here? What are you doing there? So
Wow.
It's actually really, it's good. This symposium was one of the first doing that type of technique, which I think is why it became so popular.
What's it called?
Baker-Gordon meeting.
Baker-Gordon
symposium on face
symposium.
Facial plastic
okay.
surgery. Yeah.
That's so interesting.
On plastic surgery. Yeah. Okay. No, it's a good meeting.
You want to sign up to the model?
Me? Yeah, I'll go. I'll do it. That's why I was imagining. Am I on stage? Where am I in this? Okay, but quick question too, because I think a lot of women, again, and I'm sure if we had this as an open forum, there'd be so many questions, which we should think of doing at some point. But, you know, a lot of people are looking at their necks, right? And, you know, to your point earlier, you might do your neck and then you have a tight neck, but your jowls are down. But regardless of that, I've heard that neck surgery, neck tightening is very painful. And I mean, I'm sure it's all painful, but
not, you're talking about non-surgical neck tightening devices? Like
I'm talking about like surgical neck tightening.
Well, I view neck lifting and facelift almost as one procedure. So I almost very rarely will do a neck lift alone, okay. except for rare cases where a younger patient has had massive weight loss and they have a dangly neck and their jawline's still crisp. Because if you pull the neck back with your finger, I mean, you can do it, Catherine, just pull it back with your...
If you take
your finger just below your jaw and slide it back. Now, if you look at your ear, just in front of your ear, there's usually some extra skin there.
Hard to tell on the Zoom, but...
But that's generally what happens. So the skin of the lower face and the neck are really contiguous. And so if you just lift the neck, you're going to get a little bit of bunching up around the ear. And then, you know, that's why we usually do a face and neck lift together. Now, in a younger patient who's lost weight, who's got a premature aging neck, then you can make an incision just behind the ear down into the hairline, like the back half of that facelift incision, and lift it up. But I wouldn't say pain's something that patients complain of. Like I don't find... The surgical part of the operation, post-operative patients tell me they feel pretty good.
Really?
I find the patients mostly complain about drains that we use, because we do put little plastic drains in for 24 to 48 hours. And they're a little uncomfortable when you're sleeping because they come out at the back, and when they're rolling on them, they feel weird. But once the drains are out, patients seem to be very comfortable.
What about for patients that get neck lipo?
Neck lipo is that's a very minor procedure.
Minor.
We often do that just under local, and it's well tolerated. That's not a painful procedure at all. The ones that I would say patients complain of discomfort most are the energy devices like laser resurfacing, because that you're creating a controlled burn over the whole face. And the patients often need that, and the results are enhanced by it, but they have, you know, they have to put, Aquaphor and stuff to keep their face moist throughout the recovery, and they may feel like they have a bad sunburn for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the ones that hurt the most are the non-surgical devices that are trying to tighten things, like Althera. We used to have patients that described that as extremely painful, and I think the company went back and made some tweaks to it. I don't have that device anymore, but we had a similar device, and patients that complain of it. Do you use that?
So I don't have Althera, but I remember when we got Morpheus at one of the clinics that I work at, I actually had it done. So Morpheus is, again, one of the ones that does the combination of radio frequency and microneedling. And you're supposed to have three treatments. And I didn't actually go back for the third because it was so painful that I just didn't want to get the third treatment. And they put numbing all over the face, and it was still that painful. And I even took two Tylenols beforehand. So it can be really painful.
Wow.
Yeah, so
Morpheus is uncomfortable. We've had Morpheus for years, but we make patients use nitrous oxide if they're doing Morpheus, because without the nitrous, it like kills.
Well, exactly. So you have to use a painkiller. Now we have Silfirm X now, which is another brand of this radio frequency microneedling. And it's funny because it's like these things are expensive, and you don't get the same bang for your buck. It's hard to know. You don't see the obvious difference, like, oh, wow, look. But over time, you wonder if maybe getting those treatments did help my face a little better.
I like microneedling radio frequency. I think it was a very big sort of new device that was added into the toolbox of anti-aging. The thing that's interesting about it is, like, I've had Morpheus. I think we were the second clinic in Canada with it, because I was friendly with Steve Mulholland, who was involved with the InMode company and brought it in. And sort of convinced me it was a good idea. So we added in relatively early, but then we see, then it was so popular, tons of clinics got it. And then patients online were describing fat atrophy. And there's some well-known surgeons online saying how it's a terrible device and causes all sorts of problems and fat atrophy. I haven't seen fat atrophy in our practice, so it may be related to different device settings. I mean, we have, we've been using conservative settings for, I don't know, maybe even as long as 10 years now we've had that device. And we've had Silfirm as well.
You have to go a lot deeper to get that. And if it really caused so much fat atrophy, it would be really much more effective on the body than it is. You know what I mean? Like, I don't believe it caused
fat. Are you guys talking about the Morpheus 8 or the radio frequency? Morpheus 8.
Morpheus 8 is the combination of radio frequency and microneedling.
Oh, okay. But there are other machines, though, that are microneedling radio frequency.
Correct.
There's a lot of them. Yeah, there's a bunch of devices. Silfirm, Morpheus, Potenza are kind of the three biggest ones probably on the market. And they all have some unique features. Each of the manufacturers will tout theirs is better for different reasons. The way they deliver the energy and, the depth of the needles and whether the needles are unipolar, bipolar, insulated, non-insulated. There's lots of little things. But the truth is, I don't know if anyone really knows exactly which one's the best or, you know, I think they're all working similarly.
It's also dependent on who's doing it, right? You have to go to someone reputable that's been trained well and knows how to do it. Because if you go to somebody and they're not using it properly.
What are the risks with that? Because a lot of people offer these things. How do you know who's good?
Well, if you're going to like a med spa and there's no on-site physician or a physician affiliated with the clinic, then you're kind of going into the Wild West a little bit because you don't know how much supervision is taking place on it and what type of training. But it's a pretty safe device, I think. But you, like anything else, if it's done by someone who doesn't know what they're doing or not trained, you can cause like theoretically fat atrophy, burns, scarring, pigment changes if you do it on the wrong skin types, wrong settings. So it's like lasers. All those fall under the same category. Lasers, microneedling, radio frequency are all known as energy devices, and they all require training and skill set. It's like the public think, oh, this one's the best one. You know, my neighbor on the street will say, oh, is this the best laser? There's no such thing as the best in medicine. It's what's a good device and used appropriately for the right skin type and the right indications. I mean, there are some devices that are not great, but in the higher end of things, there's a bunch of devices now that are very, very good, but they still also have limitations. They're not going to necessarily do what the patient thinks they're going to do. So we see tons of people who've blown. The commonest thing I see is patients who've blown tons of money on microneedling radio frequency, don't feel like they got enough of a result, but they may have got a good result. They just didn't get a result that they'd hoped for specifically on laxity of their neck. They've done Sculptra, which is a biostimulant, which is a great treatment. We offer it. I'm sure Melissa does too. And it has great indications, but it has some potential limitations and side effects. And they've done lots of filler. And then they're coming in not looking how they think they want to look. They look a bit potentially overfilled, puffed, not, you know, lax. And they've spent money on energy devices, injectables, and biostimulants. So they've done everything other than surgery. And those are the patients now that are they've developed the courage now to see a surgeon. And it's not that they've wasted their money on all these other things. It just, they weren't the right things for them to start with. They probably should have done surgery followed by some of those things that maybe they would have looked way better and felt that the results from the other stuff was worthwhile. But when you're, it's almost like you got to do them in the appropriate order as well.
So before we switch over to some market talk, just financially, what are people looking at to get a facelift?
Well, I can tell you my fees. The fees are really hugely variable depending on what jurisdiction you're in. So if you're like in New York City and you're known as a top surgeon and people are seeking out your surgery, the cost for surgery, like a facelift procedure, used to be $25,000 US, has gone up to about $250,000 US over the last 5 to 10 years. It's crazy.
How is that possible? like 25,000 up to 250.
It's because the markets allowed it, because you have so in jurisdictions where there's so many wealthy people who are willing to, you know, movie stars, models, celebrities. I guess they just want to go to whoever they perceive as the top person, but the fees have gone wildly crazy. I'd say it's more likely around 100,000 US for facial rejuvenation and with a good, well-known surgeon with a reputation in Manhattan. In Toronto, I'm charging 30,000 for a deep plane facelift. That's just the face. And then if you add on the eyes, a brow lift, it could be 60 to 70,000 plus, you know, including facelift, laser resurfacing, blepharoplasty. So we've tried to keep our fees sort of in a normal ballpark for the Canadian, you know, clientele, but we are getting lots of people coming, requesting to come from upstate New York, New York City, other parts of the states, especially because of the dollar differential now.
Yeah.
So we are just now about to announce that we have American insurance, but it was sort of something I had it years ago and I got rid of it over COVID because I held it for the COVID period. And obviously we couldn't see, no one was crossing the border. So the insurance was expensive and it really didn't pay to have it. So I got rid of it and I didn't bother renewing it. But now with so much interest of Americans coming here, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, they'd rather come to Toronto and say, we've had a few New Yorkers come up. Often they're ex-Canadians who've moved to New York, still a family in the GTA, and they've done shopping around and have come to see, I'm sure, some of my other
colleagues. That's interesting.
And
so we've talked about that too, like medical tourism, especially because, you know, with our dollar being so much cheaper, and also even things like Botox is so much cheaper in Canada than it is in the US. But like you said, do you need, like, I don't think our college or our Canadian Medical Protective Agency, whatever, I don't know how protected we are if we treat a non-Canadian, like,
yeah,
if you need separate insurance, like you said.
Yeah, so I'm familiar with it. In general, the CMPA will not protect you if you're soliciting or treating patients from outside of Canada. They'll treat you for anything relating to your practice in Canada or non-Canadians who are living in Canada. So if someone's here doing a PhD for a number of years, has a residence in Canada, and they come to see you, then they can't be denied medical care. So they're covered from an insurance perspective. But if you're treating a patient who's flown in for a facelift and flying home a week later and they get a complication and litigated, they will not protect you. So you have to have separate insurance. Even if someone came up and had Botox injection and went back to Chicago, we've had tons of people come up. They're shopping in Toronto, show up for Botox. And I've turned them away because I just don't want to take on the risk, even though the risk is so low. But if you buy the insurance, you have to buy insurance that I spoke to the insurance company and they've now got some newer policies. I guess there's interest from more Canadian physicians. So they've created some new products. I think just the pricing was unclear. So they've just, I think it was, I'm trying to remember the policy. I can tell you later. I think it was like London Life or something like that, that they were creating policies that were called error and omission insurance, which would cover you as a physician, your staff, your nursing, your anesthetist, and your facility. So you have to cover all of them. Otherwise, you have some gaps potentially. And then you have to also have carry forward periods. So in Canada, litigation can only occur for about 2 years after an incident. That's just Canadian law. But if you buy one of these policies and don't hold it for 2 years past the period, they don't cover you for the time period that you've dropped the policy. So you almost have to do a carry forward clause for 2 years after you stop practice if you're going to hold it. So some of these are the little subtleties that you have to sort of explore.
So it's interesting. There's a big market of, there are people whose job is like in the US, like VIP, like they help you figure out which surgeon to go to. So there are people like
beauty brokers.
Brokers.
Yeah. There's a few that have, I think, made and destroyed different doctors' careers.
Oh, God.
with the beauty brokers. And I think there's one in particular out of Manhattan where a lot of people seem to find that she provides them good value add. It just, I'm not really sure how she sort of sorts out who's the best surgeon for you. If there's like five good surgeons, how does she pick the best one specifically?
Yeah, and you got to wonder if they're getting kickbacks or something, or I don't know.
I don't know. In Canada, there's been a few people who've referred us work under this similar sort of title of beauty broker, but they haven't really requested any feedback. I don't know if they're just trying to build their reputation or monetize it through some other avenue.
So the last, that's the last responsibility I would want is to be a beauty broker. Anyway, speaking of broker, why don't we talk a little bit about the
market? We're all a bit broker now.
Right, that's right. We're broker now.
It's a nice segue into the broker.
Yeah. And Dr. Phil, you stay on for this if you want. You know, I think everybody knows that the markets have been incredibly volatile over the past 4 or 5 weeks or so. And we had a little bit of an uptick on Friday. So the markets were up. And the big question, right? So there's a lot of different aspects going on, right? Obviously, this is all stemming from the trade war. And investors are sitting back and really wondering, you know, what is Trump's plan? And they've been quite clear. And most recently, over the past couple of days, Treasury secretaries, et cetera, speaking about what the plan is, and that they're really kind of looking at the plan in terms of tariffs and trying to make it a more fair and level playing field for the United States, because there are the facts that in some cases, but again, it's all over the map, that the US charges less tariffs than India, as an example, or China or Canada. But this has been obviously going on for years and years and years. And so it's this blunt force that has been so disruptive to the markets. And when I say the markets, again, I always mean it as, you know, corporations and what do we do? And do we want to freeze our capital? Do we want to have a wait and see approach, which I think is really what you're seeing. And a good example of this is just taking a look at Delta. And Melissa and I were taking a look at the airline stocks the other week because they had been hit already so hard and they've gone down again. And Delta actually came out with a warning and lowered. Remember, Melissa, we always talk about when you hear from company managements, they're coming out to the market and telling you we've got to lower our forecast because we are seeing this stalled out concern as it relates to corporate travel, mm-hmm. as well as leisure travel. So that's, yeah. And we not only have we heard it from Delta, we've heard it from other companies as well over the past week out there thinking we've got to lower our forecast. When I say forecast, right? Stocks or companies, they trade on what the forecast is, right? So if you are going to have really great earnings growth, you'll see that stock move higher because they think that they're going to have great results. And the opposite is true. So you saw, you know, the Delta stock go down. The airlines are down. Over the past month, airline stocks are down 27%. Lodging stocks are down 15%. Cruise lines are down 26%. And the S&P is down by about 7%. So, you know, there's a lot of concern, obviously, about how these tariffs are going to impact the overall economy. And there's a lot of people concerned about a recession. Many investors are saying, well, we also know that President Trump likes to have a market that goes up. But they've kind of been a little bit more clear, the administration, that is, that they're more focused on the economy mm-hmm. versus the stock market. And so that's causing a lot of big investors and institutional investors to wonder, you know, is Trump going to come in and kind of save the day on the stock market front? Kind of telling you that they're not. At the same time, you've got, this is a period where, you know, I think really smart, sophisticated, professional investors are sharpening their pencil, like I was doing the other week, and I said I was too early and I did buy an airline stock. But you know, you want to almost have your buy list ready. And I think maybe we saw some of that buying and that money being put to work on Friday because the market was up, but you know, the weekend, everybody then sits and watches the news over the weekend. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what's called, if there's follow through from that strength on Friday into Monday, if there is, that might be taken as a positive sign. And one of the reasons why there might be is because we've seen such a pullback in the markets that the bullish case, or why one would be positive right now, is because you have what's called oversold conditions and or there are opportunities. So you do have, and you have a lot of strategists out there right now and analysts highlighting the fact that, you know, as an example, Walmart is down 19% since mid-February, which is big for a company the size of Walmart. That's a big outsized move to be down 19% since mid-February. So I think you have a lot of strategists on Wall Street taking a look at these various areas that have been specifically hit, like the consumer, right? People are very concerned about the consumer right now. So those retail stocks, is there an opportunity to buy Walmart right now, just as an example? So you're seeing that take place. I'd also just point out that on the TSX, again, it was up on Friday because, the markets were just a little bit more, well, less negative, I would say. But we are seeing layoffs in the Canadian steel sector. There's about 23,000 or so people that are directly hired or employed within the steel sector, but there's all the other ripple effects from, those people, right? And the ancillary industries that are also affected. So, you are seeing that impact here. We actually did have the Bank of Canada. I don't know if you both caught this, but the Bank of Canada did cut the interest rates last week. So again, trying to make the financial conditions a little bit easier by having lower interest rates. Again, that's not always good because it tends to lower the Canadian dollar, which means you're just importing inflation with your Canadian dollars because they're worth less. I'll stop there. Thoughts,
Yeah.
questions?
There's just so much uncertainty. I don't think anybody can really predict what's going to happen. So I think, like you said, just to sort of sit back and not get too emotional about it, not go and sell off all your stocks at a low,
Right.
and just sort of wait and look at companies that you think have a competitive advantage that you think are good and well run,
Yep.
and wait until the they come to a price that you want to buy them at. It also could be good for the housing market because real estate has taken such a hit because interest rates have been high. And it looks like if interest rates come down, maybe all of a sudden we'll see some more house and condo sales here.
In Canada.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd also just
Well, how
point out,
about well,
go,
I was going to
yeah, go
ask you
ahead.
about the I was just going to ask you about the European markets. I never really looked at the European markets, but I just wondered how, if you could just comment on how they've been affected
Sure.
by this.
So, what's interesting is a lot of strategies over the past couple of years, and I tend to invest like this as well, is that I've always been much more US focused, and that has worked out well. But what's been interesting and it's getting in the news much more is that the European markets have been outperforming the US markets. So there's been, you might call that a bit of a, it's called a catch-up trade, catching up to the US markets in terms of performance. So I feel like when you may have heard that the European markets are doing well, and you've heard that in the news. And I find
That's
that
right.
when you, yeah. So when you hear that in the news, I often find it's too late. Right,
Right.
because it's already had a great performance, but not necessarily so. I mean, I'll take a look at it, but it's interesting when you look back over, I don't say 30 years, and I'll do it. You've still always been better off to be in the United States.
Yeah.
So it comes
It
down to
just seemed that Trump instability in North America with everything with Mexico, Canada, US tariffs, it seemed like there was nowhere to put your money. People are pulling out of the markets, maybe just had to put it somewhere that's maybe less affected.
That's right. That's right. And well, I think that they are still very affected and will be affected, especially because, if we do see some type of a recession in the States, and that is what
Right.
is of concern, it obviously affects the rest of the world as well. And there's also tariffs being put on those countries. I think what happens though, Phil, is that, when you have big institutional money and the money has to go somewhere, and it has to go somewhere where they're going to do better than their competitors. If Europe hadn't been doing anything for a long time, it's an obvious place to put money, get that 10%, whatever they've made, and get out. So the question, I guess the question is, and it's something I can look into, is how sticky is that money that moved into Europe? There are some company specific stories though in Europe that might make sense. I was listening to CNBC the other day, and which I do frequently, a lot of the banks have gotten hit. So Goldman Sachs was one stock that was being highlighted, but also Banco Santander. So you can look at some international companies as well. And a lot of the time too, that's part of having a somewhat of a diversified portfolio, but sometimes you can diversify so much that, your returns are very muted, right? So if you kind of really do your homework, which is what some big institutional investors do, they're very specific about where they want to be and why. doesn't mean you can't. So, you know, you put, you know, 60% that way and then maybe diversify a little bit. That, and that's changed. Like back in the day when I first started in the business in like 1995, you know, everybody wanted to diversify so much, but again, you kind of almost get these muted results. You know, if you know that, or you think you know that country XYZ isn't going anywhere for the next 10 years, why would you bother putting your money in there? That's my view. And I think there's a lot of investors who've come to that thinking.
Interesting.
I will say though that Ulta Beauty, do you know Ulta Beauty, Melissa?
Yeah. They got hit really hard, didn't they? Didn't like Buffett sold off his Ulta Beauty.
Well, they just reported and they had very strong results. The stock was actually up by about, well, I'm not gonna quote it, that it, but it was up because they had strong results. So my point is that there are company specific stories, you know, that can look interesting.
Well, I'll tell you, after going on this cruise, this Royal Caribbean cruise.
Yeah.
I did a deep dive into the whole industry of cruising. Like,
it was, did you?
I'm obsessed with it now. It's like you alter the different, like, there's like a culture. There's like a cruising culture. These people are professional cruisers. And you have people on the ship that have been on like 10, 20 cruises. And then the gambling and casino part of it. It's like there's a lot of people there that are getting comped. Like, you play a certain amount of slots, you get points, and then they give you these cruises and the upcharges and the, I don't know, it's a whole world. I don't think cruising's going anywhere. So maybe it's taken a big hit because of, you know, they're worried that people have less money to spend on travel. And also, I think Trump was saying how the loophole with a lot of these cruises, even though they're based in the US, they put on a flag of, like, I think Royal Caribbean incorporates in Liberia or something, so they don't have to pay taxes.
Oh,
and I think Trump is trying to close that loophole, saying, no, it's not fair. You are going to have to pay corporate taxes. And I think that's also why these cruise lines got really hit, because no one knows if that's actually going to come into a play. If that does, that concerns me more than the consumer money, because I think people, that will come back. People will again, you know, money.
Yeah.
I bought some cruise lines. Most of my money, I have professional money management, but I have a little bit that I just buy on my own. And I bought cruise lines during COVID because I thought, they're going to be all decimated. During COVID,
when they took a major hit.
So I thought, okay, I'll buy some because I can't imagine it not coming back strong. But I bought some Carnival, and I bought, I forgot the other one. I think Holland, one of the other big ones. And they sort of bounced around. They went up a little bit, but I never really got the big bang for my buck that I was hoping, that I expected to get when things got back to normal.
I was telling Catherine that I was one of the geniuses that bought Carnival right before COVID. It was my worst stock ever, my worst performing stock, but it did come back a bit, and then I sold off some. And
what about Disney? Disney was one of those ones that sort of took a big hit and then seemed to have a bit of a bounce back. What about now?
You know, I'd have to look at it. One of the interesting things about Disney, I always found, like, so going way back when you know I was on the trading desk. And I was also going to mention this about the cruise lines and the airlines. There are some sectors that are just always going to be more volatile, right? Mm-hmm. Because you've got a lot of different aspects at play. For airlines, it's consumer travel, it's leisure, it's corporate travel, it's the price of oil, it's competition, how much supply. So there, every sector has certain metrics that you have to be very, very aware of. And they're just going to be trading and volatile around that. And maybe volatile is too strong of a word, but they're going to move, right? It's not like buying a bank or a telecom company. So you really want to buy it at the right valuation with the right macro backdrop, with the right fundamentals, with the right company CEO. There's a lot of different pieces to think about. When it comes to Disney, way back when, it moved around a lot, believe it or not. And one of the reasons is because, you know, they've got their media division, they've got their parks division, they've got their consumer division. So when you look at a stock, you have to kind of look at it and say, how are parks? How's media? It's a stock that, you know, we do own, and because it is more, I think, solid and stable than it has been years ago in terms of investor reaction to all those different pieces and parts. But so I'll take a look at it, Phil. We'll talk about it in the next on the next one. For me, it's a company that you can kind of buy and hold, which is, I feel, different than it was back in 2005.
Yeah, I don't think Disney's going anywhere.
Well, that's it.
I think that I'll probably, you know, my kids will probably take their kids to Disney World, to Disneyland. Like, I don't think that's just going to go away.
Right. And don't forget, too, the movie side of the business and the cost as it relates to releasing movies. So there's a lot of different aspects to that. And sometimes, Phil, you know, you sit there and you wonder, okay, well, where do I want to spend my time in analyzing different companies? And that's why they have, I don't know if you're aware, but for each investment bank, they have analysts that cover specific sectors. And I actually used to do that. So when I worked at William Blair in the States, I covered specialty retail and e-commerce back in 1997, 98 through 2000s. And all I did all day long was keep on top of 15 companies.
Yeah.
Building the Excel spreadsheets, you know, understanding what their earnings were going to be and therefore what their stock price performance should do, communicating that to institutional investors and the traders on the trading desks. That was my job. And, but I say that in the sense that, you know, the S&P 500, there's 500 companies, and here I am, a specialist covering 15. Mm-hmm. So then there's somebody else doing another 15 in another area and another 15 in another area. And, so, you know, I'm saying that in the sense that you don't have to be an analyst, but at all, right? Because like Melissa and I talk about this, you just kind of have to, as she's done, I think done really well, is what makes sense? Like, what product am I using? Am I using a Tesla? Am I using Netflix? What am I using? And that's really the Peter Lynch model of investing. He was a famous portfolio manager, and just really observing like what's going on around us, right?
What would you say the best, I don't know if there is a best, but in terms of protecting yourself against inflation, like an inflation hedge type of investing? Because it seems that with tariffs and with the current inflation in the system, it just seems like that's what's really eating away at everyone's savings.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And again, I don't know that there's a best, but I was in a really interesting investment meeting years ago now, because everyone is looking for inflation protection, right?
Yeah.
And the reality is you can't even do inflation protection. You have to beat inflation, which is even more of an onus, right?
Right.
And so how do you do that? I don't have a good answer, but I will follow up with you on that.
Like, I know gold was something people touted, and then you'd have people who loved gold and then people who said gold is not a good investment. I remember walking with friends during COVID debating this, because we thought, oh, okay, it's stable, and then people are like, I'd rather own Bitcoin than gold. And
well, that's, I don't know, it. They, yeah. So those would be the two obvious ones that people talk about, gold and or Bitcoin, right? And it's interesting because, you know, someone like Warren Buffett doesn't believe in buying gold, because how are you actually going to use it, trade it? And there's a cost to store it, right? But then there are people who absolutely do believe it's an inflation protection. And when you look at Bitcoin, in some ways, what's most interesting about it to me, and I think to many people, is that the central bankers around the world can't control it. And what's been going on for years is that the more money that the central bankers have been printing has been devaluing your money. And that's a significant part of the issue as to why we're all feeling eggflation. I mean, that's just one of the reasons, right? They just keep printing money, debt, interest payments. So they've devalued the value of your dollar through all of this, keeping the system afloat. And that's one reason why people are significant believers in cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. But nobody obviously knows the right answer, Phil. So you know, I personally have been involved in crypto for a number of years now. And I don't own any gold. But gold's obviously done very well, but there's times where it doesn't. So difficult to say.
Right.
I think honestly, owning just good, solid companies at the right price, and even ones that pay dividends, Melissa and I talk a lot about that, is a very, I don't want to say simple, but it's, I think it's worked. for very, very, very long time. And it's one of the things when I mentioned, people are sharpening their pencils right now in terms of, what stocks do I want to buy? I've also been hearing a lot about people now looking for dividend stocks because they don't know what the stock price is going to do and why not get paid to wait, right? And I've said to Melissa and on this podcast for the past probably 5 years or so, I've been building my own dividend portfolio when I see opportunities. And I'm doing this so that my money is going to work for me for a very long time, right? And so as an example, I bought ExxonMobil, I don't know, 5 years ago or so when everybody hated energy stocks, thinking we're never going to need oil in 2030. But of course, I'm sitting on the anchor desk interviewing, one top, two top energy portfolio managers, and they lay out everything. And the facts are the facts. It's only about 10% of the world or oil cons or energy consumption that isn't, carbon based. 10%. And that's been this figure for a very long time. It really hasn't changed much. So I don't see us moving to electric or what have you for quite some time. So anyway, so I bought Exxon with an, 8 or 9% dividend yield. So that's what I'm collecting on an annual basis. And I also bought Altria. So smoking. I'm like, so, some people would say that's a sin stock, but I was
Now
okay with it.
it's not a sin stock anymore. It's a Zin stock. There's Zin product.
Zen.
It yeah. These Zins. Have you seen people using this?
No.
Crazy. It's like their main thing. It's like they've gotten people off cigarettes. Now they're into vaping. And then Zin. It's like this. It's like it's what that
The pouch,
RFK
right?
Jr. I think is using. Like they throw these things into their cheek and they suck on the nicotine. Like they suck on it
Oh.
and they get a huge nicotine hit. And it's very addictive because it's got so much nicotine. I think it's one of their biggest producing performing products. Not good.
So, no.
But
I have a question about style of investing. Maybe this is a silly question, but I'll ask it because historically, like people would talk about buy and hold philosophy and that you have time on your side. But in the last, like, I don't know, last decade to me, it seems like there's so much volatility with geopolitical upheaval, pandemic, so on. There's opportunities to sort of be nimble and move and make the big decisions. Is that something that you encourage people to have managers that are active managers versus passive managers, or do you think that being reactive, because I always hear the words from my managers, you don't want to be reactive, but then suddenly they're being reactive. So I just so I kind of always like laugh to myself. Like in most businesses, you don't want to be reactive and you want to give it time, but then it seems that some people who are active and ahead of the curve can make some not like flippant decisions, but some good decisions based on just big things coming down the pipe. Like we've known about Trump being talking about tariffs and stuff for like a few months. It hasn't been a secret, but suddenly everyone's in a panic about it. And the markets are selling off. Like maybe if if you have a certain type of approach that you're going to be more reactive, maybe it benefits you in times like we're seeing now.
So I would say a couple of things. And this goes almost to the structure of the industry, like Wall Street and Bay Street, right? And so maybe I'm getting too much into the weeds, but it's important. You probably have a financial advisor, and that financial advisor either, buys and sells stocks for you, or he outsources it to, a serious money manager, right? That works at a mutual fund company or a hedge fund, right? And those people do analyze companies all day long, right? So that's the institutional side. That's what I was on. And they're not out there gathering clients' assets. Their only focus is managing money and also hedging. And they know how to use derivative products so that the market goes down, they're able to buy puts and they're able to neutralize the downside. So that's a very sophisticated side of the business, right? And I do think you want exposure to that, and you can get it through money, like money managers and hedge fund managers. The, a financial advisor is really more talking to you about let's plan this, let's plan that. They probably have a model portfolio that the investment bank gives them and they buy those stocks. There's nothing wrong with that. I do both. I have both. But they're not, their goal is to gather assets, right? So they're out there prospecting. When you're on the institutional side, there's a whole slew of salespeople that bring in the money for you and you manage it. So do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. It's like you being a surgeon versus talking to everybody about, I don't know, a mole or a hair follicle, or like you're focused. It's the same thing within the industry. It's just how it's set up. All to say, when you have a, just let's call it a hedge fund manager, they have different styles in investing and they tend to be more fast. I don't want to say reactive, but yes, they will have said, hey, we've seen Trump before. We're going to put in all these hedging strategies. We're going to be looking for opportunities. So, but that's somebody who does this, you know, 24/7. Okay. I would say though, that for the average person, us sitting here, there are just some sectors and stocks that are more trading oriented and more volatile, where yes, if you did make a nice gain, you probably would want to take profit off the table. And I think institutional investors are very good at that. They always have they tend to have, you know, a limit on the upside and the downside in terms of when they'll either take profit or when they'll get out. Like some of the big hedge funds I covered, if they're down 10%, they're out of that stock.
But I don't, this is something I don't understand. So if you say that, then that would be right now, they would all be selling, which is exactly what we're told not to do. Don't panic sell. Don't sell when the market's dipping, buy the dip. And so if they're, it's very contradictory.
Right. Well, but also,
so I just think I gotta just ignore that all.
Well, I think what's most important, why you see the movement in the market, Phil, is everybody has a very different style. Right? The market is made up of all styles. There's not one right way or one wrong way. Obviously, the people who are doing it one way think it's right, but it might not be right. But as an example, you know, and this was a bit of a mistake on my end, I bought Tesla right before the US presidential election. I think I made about 60% or so, at least, you know, within a very short amount of time. I didn't take profits because I didn't really feel like trading Tesla. I just know I want to own it long term. And the stocks come down significantly. So okay. For a stock like Tesla that we know is volatile, you know, I should have. So there's, I should have. But an Exxon that's not volatile, I've never sold a share. Yeah. I've never sold a share. And I've, you know, made over 100%. So you have to sometimes just look at the stock and know how volatile it is. And you can just bring up a Yahoo finance chart. And if it's going like this, you kind of know. And I always look at things on a, you know, short-term basis and over a 10-year basis. And, you know, does it continue to grow? Does it continue to grow its revenue? Does it continue to grow its dividends? And if that's the case, I don't have to trade it. Does that help at all?
Interesting.
Does that help at all?
I think it helps. It makes me sort of think that I got to, in my own mind, look at a stock, whether it's a long-term hold, blue chip, going to be there forever, yes. Like maybe like a Disney, you're buying until the day you die and leaving it for your kids, and versus something that's got volatility in it. And when it's on fire, maybe take your profits. Cause I feel like you're wired to kind of think, oh, well, I don't want to sell cause it's on its way up. But then when it starts to turn, it seems to fall like a, what do they say? Like a hot knife or something. So
yeah, I'm in
a falling knife. I have a stock I'm in right now that went from, I won't name it, but it's a friend of mine's company, which actually is doing really well. It's had year after year, like increases in profits, increase in dividends. And it went public at around 10, fell as low as 6 due to some market volatility, and went as high as 40. And now it's down. This last week, it fell from 40 to mid to low 20s. So it's even though they came out with record profits, so just the market forces seem really, really to be affecting that stock, even though it's a growing company that's reporting the best recorded profits they've had. The stock market's not treating it well. Maybe that sector is just being under scrutiny. There's a sell-off on the market. Maybe there's... you know, people taking profits and putting downward pressure on it. I don't know.
All of the above. You're right. All of the above affects that. And then at the end of the day, you have to sit back and say, what's the valuation of this company? Because that's what the market will ultimately pay for and continue to pay into. Because sometimes there's just momentum in these stocks. And then when the momentum leaves, then it's like, good luck seeing that $40 again, or you're going to be waiting. Right. And there are investors. So when I was on the institutional side, and we should wrap it soon, but when I was on the institutional side, I had my clients again. So when I talk about institutional, that means the firm as a whole manages 5 billion, 10 billion, right? And each of my portfolio managers might have a billion or two under management, or not under management, but their portfolio. But they could be growth investors, so they'll only buy a growth stock. Value investors, they'll only buy value, which tends to be more cyclical companies. There'll be moment, there's something called a momentum investor. Momentum investors, the stock actually has to be moving up, and all the metrics, all the fundamental metrics like revenue and operating profit margins and EBITDA margins, all those things have to be moving up. And I remember once calling this big institutional investor, and because I thought this stock was, if the company was a great company, but it wasn't a momentum company. And, he blasted me. I'm like, okay, but I think, it didn't hit all, not every single metric was moving higher. And so he wouldn't buy it. That's called momentum investing. And those stocks tend to have momentum, and they might be trading higher than perhaps, the valuation might warrant. But when everything's going higher, they believe that other investors will continue to push this stock up. That there's reason to buy this for the long term, but when they get hit pretty hard.
Interesting.
I also think that, and just to wrap this from like a
Yeah.
I don't know what the word is, from like a just a lay person here, sort of like looking at it, like if you really believe in Elon Musk and you really believe in Tesla and you really believe in the company and you want to own that stock, then it's looked and dipped before. And if you think that now it's gone down quite a lot, now is actually an opportunity to buy more Tesla.
Well, you're 100% right, Melissa. And I absolutely like, it's Sunday today in Aspen, and it's sunny.
Yay.
I got the sun. Blue sky ski day. I'm so excited. So we're gonna do like first tracks. But anyway, after that, I need to sit down, and I thought this on Friday, and look at what I own. What do I want to add to? What have I
Yeah.
always wanted to own, but it was too high of a valuation. And you don't have to do your whole position at once, right? If you're going to put, X number of dollars in, put 10% in, and then another 10%.
Yeah, it was actually funny. It's exactly what I'm gonna do today too. Today was a
Are
day I wanted
you?
to. That was all last week when everything was going crazy. I was on a cruise ship. I'm like, I'm not even gonna look at this. I'm not even gonna pay attention. I'm just gonna go to my Name That Tune and Family Feud and Bingo and whatever million activities I did. But now, today, that I have some time, look at it as well.
And Phil, I'm gonna look at Disney for you. I'll just and when I say that, I'm gonna go and look at a bunch of Wall Street analyst reports and see what they have to say. And by the way, if you put in Disney and Yahoo Finance or whatever, there's so many free services these days that you might be able to get, some type of information. You should be able to get some type of information. And the reality is, anybody can pull up their quarterly results. Their 10-Ks and their 10-Qs is what it's called. And you can read the company management commentary. And as an analyst, that's what I would have to do. Every quarter, I'd read the entire 10-Qs. But it gives you an idea, and they're telling you what they're seeing. They're telling you what their strategies are and where they're planning to go. These are public documents. And you can, it's a, and that's what the analysts use to then write their reports. So you can
Can't
actually do
AI just do
this.
this now? Can't you just use AI?
You know what? You certainly can. I, in
Yeah.
fact, yeah, we what we could do
Let's see what
easily.
AI has to say. Yeah.
I'll use AI to do this.
What are
Okay.
you
And
going to
then I'm
use?
gonna,
Which AI do you use? Grok?
I do use Grok.
Because it's through Twitter?
Yep.
Grok? Yeah.
Yep. What do you use?
Well, I don't actually use it that often, but I had been using ChatGPT, but I think,
Yep.
I don't know.
What about you, Phil?
ChatGPT a little bit, but I don't use a ton of AI. I probably should start using it more.
Well, now, even when you Google something, it goes to the AI result. which I think is Gemini, right? Google has
Yes.
Gemini.
Yeah. Actually, now, so some of the stocks that have been talked about in terms of buying on the dips lately, Google, Goldman, Banco Santander.
Yeah, Goldman,
Yeah. I actually just put in, I just asked about Disney, but it didn't really come up much. So anyway, all right, let's wrap it there, Melissa. We'll do your stuff next time. And then Phil, I'm gonna find out a little bit more about what people are saying on the inflation front and Disney.
Okay, great. Listen, I
Sounds good.
appreciate you guys having me on the show, and I'm a fan, and you guys are doing a great job covering all sorts of interesting topics. So thanks for inviting me today.
Thank you for coming. All right, happy Sunday.
You too. Take care.
Okay, bye guys. Bye.